hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
X-Go, give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
X-Go, give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Because most of the time, successful entrepreneurs are not just going to be one-time entrepreneurs. VC funds, they want to reinvest in you over and over and over again. What they look for is actually how many failures have you had? When I look at someone's LinkedIn and they've worked for a bunch of big companies, but then they've had a bunch of startup failures, that to me is like awesome because they know where the red flags are. They know failures. What is up, everyone? I am your host, Charlie Shrem, and you're listening and watching another epic episode of The Charlie Shrem Show, powered by Waxman, where together twice a week, we get to dive deep with some of Bitcoin and crypto's most influential leaders, OGs, those who have been around since the early days like myself, all the stories, all the way through to truly understand how this movement came to be. We learned some of the most brilliant things. I asked the best questions. We have so much fun. And you don't get this information anywhere else. I mean, no other podcasts are the folks really opening up the way they do here. And it's amazing. So thank you, guys, because without you, we wouldn't have this show. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for leaving positive reviews. Today's episode is awesome. There was a 82 university, 50,000 student crypto program, Bitcoin-centric, part of Mouse Belt University. We talked about all sorts of topics with all students on a panel. It was a lot of fun. And we're bringing that program to you right now. Enjoy. Have a great week.
Hey, everyone. It is Patrick McLean, co-founder of Mousebelt, and your host here for this Reimagine, which, as you know, we're lucky enough to be able to bring together some really well-studied people who've been in the history for a long time, very impactful people and students from all around the world to kind of have interesting conversations. I think this guest I'm personally very excited about, and we'll get to that in a second. But before I go on too long, I'll let Anthony, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Anthony Garrett. I'm a senior at Gonzaga University. I'm in Spokane, Washington. I'm a member of the Spawn Fellowship in their second cohort. But I'm currently working on two projects with one of my professors here at Gonzaga. One is called DeFi Steward, and the other is called Bankless Advisor. I'm just really excited to be on this chat and excited to get it going.
Thanks for joining us. Danny, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. So I'm Danny Cook. I'm a junior studying mechanical engineering at University of Illinois. I'm one of the co-founders of Illini Blockchain, which is University of Illinois' blockchain club. And right now I'm continuing to build out that on the partnership side, and we're starting our own podcast. So it's been fun to meet a lot of people and learn from them.
Awesome. Well, hopefully you enjoy this experience. But I'll let Charlie introduce himself here in a second, but I want to add a little color before you do. So, I've been lucky to spend a decent amount of time. Like, I've spent 10 hours with interviews with Roger Ver. I've spent 10 hours with Lynn Ulbricht. I've spent 10 hours with Craig Wright, Eric Voorhees, right? Like, I've been pretty lucky to kind of see these guys or people who have like really been at the intersection. I think you're one of those people in my mind. So I've always like been curious to have a chat with you. And I think in this moment of time, where probably is one of the most testing times for crypto, like what just happened with FTX and, you know, the last year with Luna and everything. So do you mind giving the audience just like introduce yourself, like give a bit of background of kind of how you came into crypto? Obviously, it's a long story. You can, you know, try to keep it condensed, but I'm really curious to hear your thoughts of like, where are we in this moment? Like in the whole time you've seen it, the history, like what are your reflections about now? But I'll shut up and I give it to you, Charlie.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for having me and putting this together. I think what you guys are doing and having this in front of tens of thousands of students continuously doing it, you guys are the soldiers, the guerrillas out there, like bringing people on to crypto, to Bitcoin, why it's important, why, you know, the questions that you know, you're talking about bringing on all those early Bitcoin OGs, my friends, there was a reason that we all got into this in the first place before Bitcoin had any value, before we even thought it would have any value. And to really understand how we're going to get through these very trying and testing times, like you said, it's even worse. There are three potential banks, Silvergate, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature, First Republic Bank now, almost four banks that are like people are looking at as potential fail, nothing to do with crypto, but it's just of the trying days that we're in, the macro world, and then FTX and some of the other ones. But to understand like how to get through it, we got to go back to the early days. Thanks for introducing me. My name is Charlie Schrem, and I got involved in, I guess I'm your long lost Bitcoiner friend, as I tell people, because I'm still around. And most of the earlier Bitcoiners like Roger, Eric, and most people don't really know of the ones who have kind of faded away during what I call the last days of Satoshi, during the days that Satoshi was still with us and we could ping him and talk to him and stuff like that. During those days, I mean, it was wild. It was the wild west of Bitcoin and it was amazing. And friendships were formed, fortunes were made, fortunes were lost. I think like all the people that got involved in the early days of Bitcoin when this was pre-crypto, pre-Ethereum, it was like during the ashes of the 2008 financial crisis when it was worse than it was today. We saw property values going down like by half. Banks were failing. People were losing trust in a lot of institutions. Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns. It was just a collapse of the whole American, the global financial system. It took some countries in Europe almost a decade to get out of those recessions, like Spain. Spain is just now coming out of it, like after 2008. So this was a very trying days of discontent. And these were pre-Venmo days. There was no, people don't realize that during 2008, 2009, the internet was still budding. And when Bitcoin was launched, there was no such thing as peer-to-peer payments other than PayPal, which other people needed a PayPal account to have and then sending and then waiting for the money to go back into your bank account. You weren't going to dinner with friends and like saying, hey, let's split a bill with our Venmo account or whatever. This was pre-peer-to-peer payments. The financial sovereignty didn't exist. These type of conversations that we're having now, personal finance wasn't taught in universities as much as it is now. People didn't really care to manage their own finances. We were taught that our employer will do our 401k and we'll have retirement, Social Security. Let's just let the government run everything. And when the government had failed us, these were the ashes that Bitcoin had launched out of. So everyone who was getting involved in Bitcoin back then were like disgruntled with the world from in one way or another. You had like anarchists, crypto anarchists. You had just kids like me who grew up in a religious community. I was looking for my way out, you know, financial freedom and way to have something new and different, something that I can call my own. But really, the Bitcoin community back then was just made up of people that were, as I would call us, like people who didn't fit in the traditional world at the time. And so we all got together, you know, not by choice, into the early Bitcoin chat rooms and the IRC networks and Skype rooms and Bitcoin forums. And we talked about changing the world and making the world a better place with this thing Satoshi gave us.
And then do you find some irony? Like I find, or I was listening to a talk you gave, you were talking about like a BitInstant. You're like, I was horrible at raising money. I had the same problem. Like I didn't fit the model of these like VC people that they wanted to see, right? Like, do you find it a bit ironic, like seeing the Sam Bankman Fried kind of maybe like quote unquote fit that model and like that was the face of crypto now and then ends up taking it down?
I was telling someone this morning that like Silicon Valley Bank wouldn't bank BitInstant because I was not bankable. I wasn't from Silicon Valley. I didn't go to Stanford University. I was this Jewish kid from Brooklyn that grew up in a very religious community. So I didn't have that pedigree. So I was very uninvestable. And that's one of the takeaways that I will, you know, when investors are investing in your startup or your business, they're not just investing in your idea. In fact, that's the least of their worries. The investors are investing in you. Because most of the time, successful entrepreneurs are not just going to be one-time entrepreneurs. VC funds, they want to reinvest in you over and over and over again. What they look for is actually how many failures have you had? When I look at someone's LinkedIn and they've worked for a bunch of big companies, but then they've had a bunch of startup failures, that to me is like awesome because they know where the red flags are. They know failures. Guys like Sam came out of feeling of like, I'm better than everyone else because I had this pedigree and therefore my risks are not as risky as if you were to do the same thing that I was doing. Because, and it was like I don't know the term for it, but we digress a lot into like what were the failures of today. But I want to go back a little bit to those early days. BitInstant came out of a need. It was the first Bitcoin exchange. It was the first way to buy and sell Bitcoin. And I launched it with a couple of friends from the Bitcoin forums. And at one point we were like 30% of the Bitcoin transaction volume. It was the only time that I was written about on TechCrunch. And it was like a big, you know, badge of honor for me. In those days, there was no real way to buy and sell Bitcoin. And we knew, and the reason that we'd started was we knew that for this Bitcoin thing to be successful, we just needed to get in the hands of as many people as possible. And we need to explain to people why it's so important. And the reason it's so important was we can work our butts off all of our lives and our assets can be taken from us. And our data can be changed and our transactions can be changed and can be frozen and can be held back without due process. And we saw a lot of that. And then look at the trucker protest rally that we just saw, how the government can freeze everyone's bank accounts. It's just the tip of the iceberg. So Bitcoin and crypto is, for me at least, was about like sovereignty. It was about having my own assets that I worked for that couldn't be taken away from me. My parents couldn't take it away. My religious community couldn't take it from me. And the government couldn't, without due process, take it from me. Because we see that. We were seeing civil forfeiture where they can just take it. We were seeing a lot of negative things. And I'm not talking about like the American government. It's unfortunately the best of the rest of them. Because you try to have some assets in other countries around the world. I mean, it's not safe. It's a scary thing in a lot of places. So Bitcoin was not created for the first world. And if you look at where Bitcoin and crypto are the most successful right now, it's not in the US. It's all over Latin America. It's all over Europe. It's all over, especially Eastern Europe, Africa. I mean, it's huge in Africa. They're using Bitcoin and crypto on a daily basis. They're using it everywhere because they have a need for it. Their monetary systems are built on cell phone minutes. Before Bitcoin, they save their cell phone minutes are the only valuable thing.
I lived in Tanzania for years and I saw it like a decade ago. They're using M-Pesa. And I'm like, M-Pesa. I think people don't understand. I'm like, these people are just going, getting a scratch card, loading their cell phone and texting money to their friend, right? And they were doing this a decade ago and it was common. Like
Bitcoin and crypto isn't the problem. It's the solution. You don't have to worry about you're controlling your own assets. Friction is freedom. We need to create a little bit of friction in order to show people the light. And so if we need to like put crypto in our apps and teach people why this is important, like when you use Bitcoin in the Cash app, I love it. It teaches you why Bitcoin is important. There's like a whole thing. And that's because Jack Dorsey and Matt Carollo and all the folks who are like running that are all Bitcoin OGs and Bitcoin developers. You can tell the companies that are doing crypto and Bitcoin where the ethos of the Bitcoiner is in their blood. Kraken's another example. Jesse Powell, who founded Kraken, early friend of mine, we worked together. But Bitcoiner, being a Bitcoiner is in his blood. And so you can go out there and be a crypto person and love crypto and do crypto things and DeFi and NFTs. And if you could do it with the ethos of what it means to be a Bitcoiner, you'll have the most successful company. Because what that means to be a Bitcoiner is not having the private keys for your customers. Figure out a solution in order to decentralize your software where from a liability perspective, you're not in control of anything. There are DeFi projects out there that are doing that. And that's what it means to be a Bitcoiner. It's like JFK said, ich bin ein Berliner. And they tear down the Berlin Wall. We're all Berliners. Ich bin ein Bitcoiner. We are all Bitcoiners at heart. And that's what I love about the crypto world today is we're seeing like a huge resurgence in that.
And I'm going to give it to you next, Danny. But yeah, to your point, I mean, like, if you look at what Eric Voorhees did with Shapeshift, right? I mean, he's literally like, I don't want to spy on my customers. My customers don't want me to spy on them. I don't want to spy on them. But then this third entity over here is trying to force me and to do something that none of us want, right? So what does he do? He goes and decentralizes his whole company and goes, all right, guys, like, there you go. Like, you know, so there's definitely people, I think, that are spearheading that. But hey,
major companies are realizing it too, though. I did a podcast. I have the Charlie Shrem Show podcast, and I did a podcast with the chief strategy officer at Fox Corporation, like all of Fox, Fox News, Fox Sports, Fox everything. She was the one who did NFTs for the Masked Singer Super Bowl, token gated Super Bowl, like crazy stuff. And she literally said, we at Fox believe that the more control we give to our viewer, even people watching the local news, the more money we'll make. And I'm like, that's so transparent. I love that. They're like, it's not about freedom for them. I mean, I love that they want us to have freedom. But for them, the more freedom we have, the more money they make. They realize that there is an alignment there. It doesn't have to be us or them. Using the technology can give us more freedom and more rights, but also make these companies more money. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
Definitely. A lot of points to unpack there. But hey, Danny, you want to come in here with your first question?
Yeah, of course. So I'm mainly wondering what your whole take is on, like, I guess how through crypto's evolution, since you've been through, you know, from the beginning, how has your future outlook and how it's like impact changed? I guess your opinion on how Bitcoin will be used and crypto in general, how that's changed from the beginning until now after, you know, all the ups and downs over the years.
In the beginning, I was, I'm 33 now. And when I first got into Bitcoin, I like to give the perspective, I was probably your ages. I was actually a junior in college. I went to the City University of New York and I stumbled upon Bitcoin one night while in a late night chat room, while probably doing some homework or whatever. I don't even remember what I was doing. And I had a little startup selling electronics. And so when I first fell in love with Bitcoin, I had a PayPal account, but when I was selling electronics, they kept random people were doing chargebacks for fun. And PayPal was like freezing our money for half a year. And I'm like, how are we supposed to start a business when we can't even get our cash flow to buy the products that we're supposed to send to our customers? There has to be a better monetary money system. And I went out searching for it and there just wasn't. You can collect people's credit card numbers, but that's about it. There was no like peer-to-peer payments other than PayPal. But PayPal, it wasn't truly peer-to-peer. PayPal was like maintaining the ledger and arbitrary saying who can send how much, how long it has to be frozen in your account before you can withdraw it. So that never really took off in the way that we thought peer-to-peer payments. Kind of funny that PayPal owns Venmo today, which Venmo became like the top. And Venmo makes a lot of their money from Bitcoin and Ethereum payments anyways. People load up with Bitcoin and Ethereum, send payments to each other, and then cash out. So it's like ended up being we were successful. But I thought back then that it would just be Bitcoin and it would just be money. And I thought that Bitcoin would be this, like, at first, the only reason, so you ask yourselves, like, how did Bitcoin get any value? It wasn't that just like someone opened up an exchange one day and all of a sudden people wanted to buy and sell it. I should write a little book on this because no one really understands, like, how did Bitcoin get its first value? And what happened was all Bitcoiners were concentrated in two places. What was then a forum that Satoshi had launched called forum.bitcoin.org. And then also inside of the Freenode IRC network, which I don't know if people still use IRC, but back then IRC was really Internet Relay Chat. And it was this like, it's like this decentralized chat service where people, whatever, it was IRC. And anyone can set up like channels. So Satoshi had set up Bitcoin Developer, Bitcoin General, and then Bitcoin OTC. And what happened was at first, it was just all talk about Bitcoin. How do I download the software? How do I run it? And when you downloaded the software that Satoshi had launched called Bitcoin QT, it looked like a 1990s era piece of software. You can see screenshots of it. As soon as you launched it, it created an address for you. And where I'm really showing my age now, you had to go to your router and open up port forwarding. Do you guys remember that? Like, is that still a thing where you have to like, oh no, oh my God, I'm really... So back then, in order to like play video games or do anything where you could accept incoming connections from your internet router, you had to log into your router and like open up a port. It's like it was such a manual thing. So Satoshi was sitting there explaining to people, but once you opened up that port, you are now a miner. You were validating everyone else's transactions. If Danny, you sent Anthony, if you downloaded it, Danny, and you sent Anthony a transaction, and Patrick was out, you know, doing laundry, but his computer was on, your transactions would still update on his computer. So his computer is now maintaining your transactions, and my computer is maintaining it. So all of a sudden, 10, 100, 500 people were maintaining this ledger, this Bitcoin ledger all the time, 24 hours a day. And so if someone came and stole my computer and stole your computer, Danny, our transactions are still on Patrick and Anthony's computer in real time. And now the people that were keeping their computer open, because you had to, at the time, you had to keep your computer running. Like people, as soon as you closed your laptop, it stopped doing it. You were also earning Bitcoin for doing that. That's Bitcoin in a nutshell. You were earning Bitcoin for maintaining the network. The wallet software, the mining software was all in one. And so that's what people were doing. And so that was first. But most people like myself didn't want to keep their computer hot running. And so this one guy, his name is Gavin Andreessen. Satoshi ended up passing the keys to him when Satoshi left. But Gavin set up this thing called a faucet, and he was giving away free Bitcoin to people. So now all of a sudden you got this thing going. People have all this free Bitcoin thing. They can use it in the software, but they can't use it for anything. They can't spend it anywhere. So other people in the Bitcoin forums now and in the chat rooms started to offer their like services that they were already doing for Bitcoin. So I was already selling cheap electronics. So I started putting forum posts like, hey, you know, today for 10 Bitcoin, I got you a pocket knife. By the way, you can see all this stuff. You go to Bitcoin forums, it's all preserved. You can see all these early conversations and price discovery. So I started selling stuff like cheap stuff, like, you know, little radios for, and I was selling it on my dailycheckout.com for $5 and free shipping. So now I'm getting this free. And again, this was for fun. I just wanted to collect more Bitcoin. I wanted to be the biggest Bitcoin holder in the chat room. That was me. There's no value. I just wanted to like be cool. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be popular. So other people started selling alpaca socks, honey, like things now, like valuable things, food. People were selling, some of the first things that you could buy were like MREs, those like meals. If a hurricane comes, you have meals that never expire. So now I'm buying MREs. I'm like using my Bitcoin, and this little economy was being developed. So someone just set up an Excel spreadsheet called newlibertystandard.com, and you were able to just go and buy like blocks of like 10,000 Bitcoin for like a dollar, just blocks of it in order to like be a part of this. And then eventually Jed McCaleb, who went on to found Ripple and Stellar, basically owned this domain name called magicthegatheringonlineexchange.com, abbreviated to Mt. Gox, MTGox. And he basically said, well, no one's trading online playing cards, so let me trade these online. Because what he did was he created this software to create like a digital version of a Magic the Gathering card. So he just said, we'll allow trading for these Bitcoin things. And Mt. Gox became the first Bitcoin exchange. I mean, the rest is history. But that's kind of where the history of Bitcoin in the last days of Satoshi kind of became an economy.
Amazing to hear that. You've definitely... What year did you get involved exactly?
2011 was like when I started posting and being involved and stuff like that. My earliest posts are 2011. But I think I was involved in 2010 too. I don't think I know. But in Bitcoin, if you can't prove it, don't trust, verify. Don't make a claim for something. Tell people, because people are going to go look it up.
Yeah. With ChatGPT, just put it right in.
I love ChatGPT. I'm on it all the time. I love it.
No, it's great. Anthony, you wanna kick us off here?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you briefly went over it, you know, in your explanation of like the Bitcoin incentive mechanism. But can you further just dive a little bit deeper into how that incentive mechanism like improves like morality within like financial markets, places that don't have access to banking?
From a Bitcoin perspective, the idea was, in all these places around the world, you don't have the ability to have a bank account. And it's not like people, you can't, it's not just about being able to, first of all, in most places around the world, you can't you simply just can't walk into a branch and open up a bank account. It's not even like they're not trustworthy. You just simply can't. Like if you go to, I was in Zambia, and it's a very difficult thing to do. They don't just simply, most people, I forget the percentage of the population, but it's like a super majority just don't open up bank accounts, don't trust their banks. Talk about Tanzania earlier. I was in the early 2000s. If we start there, the way that Africans were saving their money was through very regional financial service companies that they put trust in. And these were like pseudo government, private, public partnerships. And most of them were the cell phone companies, because people were already, there was a trust involved in like, give me $10, you can use the minutes, here's a value. It's like buying packets of tuna fish. There's a value proposition there. So it was very, like, that's how people were using money back then. So whereas here in the US, we were like, open a bank account when you're 18, you go to college, you start saving, you have a job. It's like, it's going to be there. JP Morgan, Citibank have existed since America has existed. So they're not going anywhere. But in these countries, they never grew up with that. And again, I was so oblivious to that. I just had no idea. And at your age, I started traveling to all these places. And that was the first thing I did with any money I earned. I just traveled. Didn't get a car. Didn't spend on assets. Traveled. I just traveled everywhere and learned and met people. And I met people at your... And the thing is that the friends you guys meet now, as long as they're smart and you have faith, invest in your friendships, because the friends that you make now are going to go on to become the politicians of tomorrow. You don't think, but my friends have went on to become ambassadors, senators, people that I could use for business relationships, political connections. I mean, my high school WhatsApp group from 2008 is like my biggest business like connection relationship, because you guys have known each other. So it ends up being like a great relationship. But when you travel, you meet amazing people. So Bitcoin allowed me to like travel, and I met and opened up my eyes to like how unfair the world was. And so you had all these people that were just getting killed, inflation, price destruction. And it wasn't just about the savings. It sucks because like, I don't want to say I told you so, because I'm in the financial system of the US, but the inflation that we have today, go on my Twitter. We were predicting this stuff in 2012. We saw the money printing that was happening, quantitative easing that was happening back then. That's why inflation exists now, because the money printer ran hot for 10 years. We had record low inflation rates, and we exported our inflation to the rest of the world. And they're the ones dealing with it. From Argentina to Cyprus to Africa, all the places where inflation is above 10% year over year. Think about that. Inflation price is going up year over year over 10%. Forget saving. And then on top of that, your currency is being devalued. That's why Bitcoin had and has value proposition. So if you look at Bitcoin from an American perspective, it's very selfish. You're just going to get pigeonholed. Eventually, if Vitalik realized that Bitcoin has bigger implications than money, and the year was 2014. I would argue that even Satoshi had the same feelings as well. Satoshi talked about Namecoin. He talked about some of the other proof of work coins that existed that weren't just Bitcoin at the time. And so originally, Vitalik, when he launched the idea of Ethereum in the Bitcoin forums, Vitalik thought that he would be launching this idea to a much more positive reception. And he didn't. They, like, the Bitcoin community went down on him hard. And that's why he ended up saying to himself, I'm going to have to launch this on like a whole separate blockchain. And that's probably one of the regrets I have personally, thinking about that. And it's funny because now the holy grail, what everyone's trying to figure out and where some of the biggest investments I see putting my like VC hat on right now is people figuring out how to bring Bitcoin and EVM compatible blockchains, which are basically like Ethereum, Polygon, and the rest of them together in a fully decentralized way. And I'm like, if we had just built it in a way to like work together, wouldn't have that been a lot easier? Then now these things are like trillions of dollars of value. But whatever, brother, you know, families break up and they come back together, I guess, is the story that will be told. But Vitalik and his brilliance realized that you can not just have people download a Bitcoin wallet, but you could have immutable data. The Arab Spring was happening at the time. People were in Syria, people were launching blog posts, but then the government was like shutting off the internet. This was the year Egypt shutting off the internet, Syria shut off the internet, South Africa, like countries were just shutting off their internets And so Bitcoin was now seen as a value proposition of like, hey, you could have immutable data, censorship resistant data and information could now exist on a decentralized blockchain, decentralized delivery systems. Because the internet as we know it today, the internet that we're using right now, Zoom, how people are listening to this, Spotify, Apple, and MP3, that's what we call a content delivery network. And those are not decentralized. Those are pretty much Cloudflare, Amazon Web Services, and a few other ones. If shit hit the fan, that wouldn't be a hard phone call for a government to call those places up and say, hey, pause the brakes here. And the only networks left standing will be this Web3 network that we're building right now. Decentralized content delivery systems, decentralized RPC, decentralized IPFS. IPFS, the Interplanetary File System, is basically a decentralized version of FTP. You go to Google Drive, you upload some documents, those documents are kept in Google servers. IPFS is, you put some documents or anything up there, billions of pieces are broken up and kept all over the world. And more importantly, the location of those pieces. This is the key to IPFS, the treasure map. Because if someone can just say, yeah, where are Charlie's pieces and they bring it all back together, then what good is IPFS? But the treasure map of how the pieces were broken and then reformed, that's Bitcoin. That's what Satoshi solved. The Bitcoin, the Byzantine generals problem. Go into ChatGPT and Google the Byzantine generals problem and how Satoshi solved that. That's the true solution. That's like, I will put money on within 50 years, Satoshi will get a Nobel Peace Prize for that. I'm putting my money on that.
I like it. A lot of interesting stuff there. I'm definitely enjoying this conversation. Like it's really good to hear your perspective, like having seen this and for such a long time. Danny, you want to go ahead?
But Danny's question, but I just want to say, Roger and Eric taught me everything I just said. Like Eric was my first crypto best friend at 21 years old. And Roger was like my big brother. Roger was my first seed investor at BitInstant and Eric was my chief operating officer. So, I mean, we were all growing up at the same time. But Danny, sorry, I overtook yourself. I apologize.
Hang on. And for anyone listening, what he just said, very true. Like, go read and understand who Eric Voorhees is. Like, you'll see countless interviews of me, like, I think way underestimated. Go truly read about who Roger Ver is, right? Like, there's a whole narrative being sold. Like, I talk to Roger, like, one of the most interesting things he tells me is, like, Patrick, I'm being called Bitcoin Jesus, right? Okay, now, fast forward years later, he's like, I'm the first money into all these projects. I'm going door to door, basically getting people to accept Bitcoin. Everyone loves him, right? Then all this shit goes down. If you guys want to research it, around, you have this block size war debate. Some of this stuff like went around, Vitalik came out, like kind of what, a lot of these things happening in this moment. And now there's like some revisionist history of people getting into crypto now. And they like hear the name Roger Ver and like he's trying to be sold as like some kind of scammer, right? Like anyone who cares about Bitcoin, like truly go read about who these people are and understand like the impact they've made. Because, we started to take these new idols like the Sam Bankman-Frieds, et cetera, and hold them up as if they invented this world and have helped everyone in some immaculate way. But the reality is there's a lot of people that I think are starting to be forgotten about in history. And it's important to kind of revisit these conversations.
I'm really excited that this podcast, The Charlie Shrem Show, is now powered by Waxman. I think I met the CEO, David Waxman, back in 2015 or something at an Ethereum meetup, and he told me that the future belongs to the fearless, and that is why they are producing the show right by my side. What an amazing team we have now. It's so amazing. You guys have been hearing some great updates, have been following along. If you don't know, Waxman is the leading global strategy and communications firm advising the next generation of companies in Web3, disruptive technology, Bitcoin, crypto, fintech, artificial intelligence, and venture capital. Waxman's clients are ambitious leaders and businesses that are on the frontier of this whole new economy because they really do believe that the future belongs to us and we're the ones building it. With services across everything from digital marketing, public relations, social media, investor relations, financial communications, recruiting, and public affairs, they're helping companies and individuals like myself seize the business opportunities that we deserve, overcome challenges that we all are going to face and achieve sustained success. Head over to Waxman to learn more. You guys are going to love them. We have them in the show notes. Check it all out. It's WACHSMAN.com. That's WACHSMAN.com.
But Danny, you want to take us in?
Yeah, of course. So Charlie, you're kind of hinting at it earlier, but I guess for Bitcoin's future and just generally speaking, crypto is a medium of exchange store value actually used as money, frequently. What do you think is holding back adoption the most? And what do you think is the ideal or most likely scenario of, like, is it going to be Bitcoin that everyone uses? Is this store of value that we're using to transact? Is it, some stable coin? Is it this merge between Bitcoin and Ethereum that you were talking about? What do you think is the most probable scenario and what you would like to see? And what might it be holding it back too?
I think that in the future, we'll probably see blockchain technology be used in a government, public, private stablecoin mechanism. And I think if it's done right, that mechanism could probably bring millions of people out of poverty around the world, because other countries will adopt those same mechanisms. And then you'll be able to remove a lot of the corruption, embezzlement, and graft out of it. Because the old adage of the closer you are to the money printer, the richer you'll get, is still very true today. And it's so true that capital doesn't like to leave trusted places. And that's why it was easy for Sam Bankman-Fried, who came out of Stanford, to raise all that money, because he came from that pedigree. And that capital, that those wealthy people who also went to those same universities and from the same pedigrees, not to say that's bad, but like, they all blindly trusted in their own capital cycle. And capital doesn't like to leave its own cycle. So if we're out of it, getting into it is very difficult, especially if you live in a lot of countries. There's a huge gap between the middle class and the wealthy elite. And that gap will never be closed, because the wealthy elite will never let their money leave the cycle of the other wealthy elite. They'll spend their money with the wealthy elite. They'll marry the wealthy elite. It'll never leave that. But I believe that if you can have the financial system on a much more like transparent playing field of who controls it, it's not perfect, but it'll get us a lot of the way there. And I feel like enough people in the middle are incentivized to make it happen, that those who are in power right now won't be able to stop it, because enough people and their children want to see a better future. Remember, I grew up in a world without Bitcoin, but if you're 13 years old or younger, you never knew a world without Bitcoin. The idea of a digital asset that could have a value only because people believe it has value, because that exists when kids are born today, existence is validation. It's automatically going to be a thing because it existed when they were born. Like, we don't believe in things. Like, if you come to me and say to me, like, hey, this shouldn't exist, that it existed since like scotch tape. It's been around since before I was born. Someone comes and like, scotch tape is bad for you. It's like, why? It's been around forever. What could be bad about it? Like, I don't know. It's whatever. It's a bad example. But Satoshi, going back to your adoption question, because that's what you asked. This is one of the things I was really bad at is active listening as a kid. Oh, sorry. My friend in a boat just came by. What Satoshi just figured out was that Bitcoin adoption was going to be just that. It's going to be very slow and long-tailed. In fact, people had asked him and other people about what the prices are going to look like. I think it was Hal Finney who said that, in the year 2050, maybe we'll see Bitcoin at this price. In the year 2035, we'll see Bitcoin at a million. And then the year 2150, the halvings and how Bitcoin is supposed to grow, it's supposed to be decades and decades and decades long. We're not even into like the fourth halving yet. It's like 13 years of Bitcoin's existence. We are so far. We've adopted and grown so much faster than I think Satoshi thought we would. And because of that, that's why we keep getting into these bubble and burst cycles, because we just get ahead of ourselves and then we burst and then we play catch up and then we get to like consensus or like some equilibrium, and then everyone gets all excited again. And then here we go all over again. And it's not going to stop happening probably for another 10 years.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth there. Like, I laugh at this point. I'm like, if you've been in like five, I mean, I've been in whatever, 6 years, like, I expect every 18 months is going to be some crash, going to be some this story is never going to end. Like,
yeah,
this is the most interesting story like ever been told. And like, it is by nature just going to like go faster, I think. Anthony, you want to shoot one out?
A potentially pretty obvious question. It's just like how to scale Bitcoin without sacrificing decentralization, because naturally proof of work is decentralized, but to scale it.
Great question.
Your thoughts?
Great question. Best question I heard long time. So the question of scaling Bitcoin goes back to, I would say, 2015, when Bitcoin started growing very quickly. During these years, I don't want to like take up too much time, so I'm trying to like abbreviate the story as much as I can. Bitcoin is growing too fast. And when Satoshi had started Bitcoin, they arbitrarily put in this like 1 megabyte block limit. And that it was arbitrarily, the number was arbitrary, but why it was put in wasn't arbitrary. It was a random number, 1 megabyte. Because at the time, and that's like basically, if you equate to that, if you equate to like Bitcoin miners as bookkeepers, it's like, how many pages can your printer print at a given time, you know? And so if we use the analogy for printers, if everyone who's running a node has a printer at their house, for Bitcoin to be the most decentralized one as possible, we want everyone having very small printers, but being able to print as many pages as possible. But as you know, small printers can't print pages fast. And they also overheat and they can't print a lot, but they're more affordable. So most people can just own, you know, millions of, you could take little printers and mail them to everyone. And therefore, going back to the analogy of like how many people are running the Bitcoin software, you want as many people as possible running these Bitcoin nodes. You want them kept small. You don't want the block size high. You want it small. However, Bitcoin was scaling at the time. So you had a huge divergence. One divergence in the most extreme said, we don't need a block size at all. And therefore, if you want to operate a Bitcoin node, you need an industrial printer. So it's more money for those industrial printers because only very few people can afford it. So it's more money for miners. It's theoretically less hackable for the individual machine because it's a bigger, stronger machine, but you can't have millions of them around the world. You can't have this, what Satoshi wanted, peer-to-peer electronic cash. But then you had the other side who said, if we keep them small, which is what the Bitcoin developers had wanted, then Bitcoin will die. And other blockchains were like doing transactions faster and better. And at the time they can do it because they weren't big enough. So their little quirky consensus mechanisms like Ethereum and whatever, because they weren't big enough yet, they could experiment with their consensus mechanisms without running into the same problem that Bitcoin had. And remember that, because Ethereum still ran into its own scaling problems later on, but it was easier for the talking heads to have their comments. But remember, so let's go back to that printer problem for a second. How do you scale the decentralized network? And you had so many brilliant people in the room. It wasn't like just kids like me now. These were like scientists. People who had built the SMS network were chiming in now, saying how it should scale. The creator of BitTorrent, Bram Cohen, you know, like these were like really brilliant scientists, physicists, mathematicians. Hell, Adam Back, who was in the Bitcoin white paper, so she quoted him, was coming out on the side of the small blockers. This literally became a war. Like this has been written about. It became, honestly, it broke up Roger and I. Roger and I are no longer friends anymore. It's sad. I miss him. Miss him dearly. As a friend, he was my big brother and best friend. And we haven't talked in 6-7 years because of this. This broke us up. And I didn't even take a side. It was that I didn't take a side. You know, Roger had dealt with a lot of family betrayals in his own life, so I understand why. I have abandonment issues too. I haven't seen my family in over a decade, so I get it. I'm not mad at Roger for being mad at me. I'm just sad about it. It's sad. I miss him a lot. If you're listening, Roger, I miss you, bro. Roger, and at the time, you had false messiahs. You had this guy, Craig Wright, coming out saying that he's Satoshi and convincing Gavin. Remember we talked about Gavin? Gavin was falsely believed into believing that Craig Wright was now Satoshi. And Craig Wright went and tried to use these block size wars to like take over Bitcoin, ended up launching his his own coin called Bitcoin Satoshi Vision. While he controlled Bitcoin Cash, Roger and Chihan finally realized that Craig was a false messiah. So that's why there's three Bitcoins now, not just two or one. It's like split. It was crazy days. In the end, and so I was part of a group that it was basically existed of like everyone in between. And we called ourselves like the SegWit 2X group. So there was this technology, SegWit. And SegWit was actually created by those same small blocker Bitcoin developers. But because SegWit was now politicized, and this is a good life lesson, is like, don't turn problems into political ones. Don't turn technical problems. Don't turn medical problems. We saw with COVID. Don't turn technical or medical or any type of into a political one. As soon as you do that, you're screwed. We saw that with COVID. The whole medical institution was at risk. We were losing trust in them. So this technology, SegWit, was now politicized. And it's great technology. We ended up adopting it. But the small blockers didn't want to adopt it anymore because the big blockers said it was like this really, really bad thing. And it just created this whole massive. And what SegWit did was, which again was created by the Bitcoin developers, was it's called Segregated Witness and stands for Segregating the Witness. And because inside of a Bitcoin block, and basically to use the printer analogy, they lowered the fucking font. That's the now the printer can print more pages. More data can exist on the same amount of pages. That's all SegWit did. But SegWit 2X, our group, it made the witness signature stronger and efficient. It made how all SegWit did was it made how we hash and derive the signature within the witness spot of the Bitcoin block. We made that more efficient and we adopted a better standard for that. Not a big political, doesn't need to be a big political thing. But a lot of small blockers really believe that by allowing any sort of like bigger blocks, you're inherently creating a bad precedent of bad scaling. I'm bringing it back to your scaling question. And so the whole adage that was talked about was smart scaling is better than fast scaling. Because fast scaling, and as we saw with Bitcoin caches, their blocks are empty most of the time because no one wanted to use it at the end. And so the way Bitcoin scaled by just adopting SegWit ended up being the right way. And going back to like, how do you scale farther from that? So that's where scaling was. So there's like always a fear of politicizing in Bitcoin scaling again, which is why you'll see it go very slow. How do you scale? There is a lot of good solutions on top of Bitcoin between the Lightning networks, Lightning Network payment channels, side chains. There's another type of chain. It's like a layer on top of. There's all these different mechanisms. Up until this point, other than including sidechains, they all give up decentralization. From my understanding of Lightning and sidechains, me as a hardcore Bitcoiner, I'm okay giving up a little bit of the decentralization for the short-term benefit of a sidechain or a Lightning payment channel because they're short-term. And then once you're out of the channels, you're back into regular Bitcoin. And what these scaling solutions use is essentially Bitcoin's proof of work checkpoint. You know, one block every 10 minutes, but then in between, they have thousands of other blocks, these other blockchains. And then they take all their blocks and they put it into a Bitcoin block. So if you're okay for a cup of coffee, you're not going to wait for the whole Bitcoin block, but you're going to be okay with the regular sidechain block. But if you're selling your house, you'll wait 10 minutes for the sidechain block to get included into a Bitcoin block. And that's my favorite scaling solution because I can explain it to you in 2 seconds.
I want to get your take, not to go like too far off here, but I think for anyone who doesn't know what Charlie's referring to, you know, go read about it, like the block size word. I think it's a very interesting inflection point. And again, it's like kind of like where you see Ethereum kind of come at the same moment. You know, if you listen and kind of like Charlie was saying, like there's two sides to this, right? Like if you want to like visualize it, maybe it's like this Adam Back people, Roger Ver, maybe like Jihan Wu, like minor guy. Now, I'm curious your take, like, and you probably understand Roger's view on this or that general concept. Like, there are like some general conspiracy theories, right, which say that there was entities who didn't want to see Bitcoin like be used as cash, right? So that big block versus small block debate kind of can boil down to, if you had a big block, you could use it to buy things like a cup of coffee more easily, and you basically treat it more as cash, right? So you're not having a taxable event, each time you buy a cup of coffee with cash. You don't have to like base the currency and have some taxable event, where if something is an asset like a house, it's taxed quite differently because you don't plan on doing that many transactions with it, right? Kind of going back to what Charlie said.
Yeah.
So by making Bitcoin, there's some theories out there for anyone like, so I'm setting some context, but I'd like to get your thought that this was kind of a moment to cripple Bitcoin as cash. And then like, obviously, you know, like the Rogers of the world say around this same time, he's getting, you know, he's like getting propaganda against him, and the Bitcoin forums and the Reddits are being taken over, right? And there's like these conspiracies about Blockstream and Adam Back, yeah, all of this. Like, what is your take there? Like, did some weird stuff happen like around that time? And like, was it purposeful?
It was very weird. And to the extent that the false messiah, like fake Satoshis that claimed to be Satoshi, to the extent all they wanted to do was create the exact narratives, like you just said, to fuel discontent, to eventually fork Bitcoin and then fork it, but change it just a little bit to either give themselves a back door or give themselves a boatload of tokens, which what they did when they forked into Bitcoin Satoshi Vision. And in fact, Bitcoin Cash has, I think, like a development fund built right into the protocol itself. So they gave themselves money. And it's plain as day, follow the money. That's what they wanted to do. Can we speak to their agendas? I've known Roger my whole life, and I don't believe to Roger have had that agenda the whole time I've known him just is a huge failure in my own like ability to judge someone's character. And I just don't think it. I don't think Roger, if anything, people like Roger, myself, and others, we constantly get taken advantage of because of our good nature. And here's another life lesson. Get a good lawyer. My lawyer is involved in like every business transaction I do because I am just a good natured person and I trust everyone. And that's not a bad thing, but you have to protect yourself because when shit hits the fan, the good natured person is the one that's going to get taken advantage of. Not by the other person, but just by the situation. And so get a good lawyer. And so I think that just Roger, myself, and these other, we're just good natured people who want to make the world a better place. And unfortunately, get taken advantage of. Gavin too.
Well, and I guess I'm kind of asking in the reverse, like, do you buy into what Roger's saying, which is that basically like the Blockstreams of the world did a conspiracy to like hijack Bitcoin? And like
Blockstream, which was launching at the time, still has massive financial incentive to scale Bitcoin in the way that Bitcoin is being scaled today. If they had increased the block size, Blockstream, that had just brought on Adam Back and all these bigwigs, would basically have raised money and for nothing. It would have been a moot point for them to even exist. Bitcoin would not need them. So of course, like, there's no reason to debate whether or not. You ever read Diaries of an Economic Hitman? Money is used, follow the money. Money is used to control and for everything. Every incentive, every war that has ever happened in the world has happened because of some financial incentive. And it's not a bad thing. Like, we're humans. At the end of the day, you're going to be married and have kids one day. And you're going to have parents and in-laws to take care of. And these are going to be your family. And whether you or your partner or the breadwinner, you're going to want to protect your family. And you're going to say to yourself, and I will stop at nothing to protect my family. Because we've all seen these zombie apocalypse movies. You know, we're not stopping on the side of the road. We're fucking going, protecting our families. So you have to remember that, like, remember that when you look at any event in history and you judge an event in history, it always. So all Satoshi did was make that transparent. He put the money on a chain that we can follow it now. And eventually those who opt in to participate, it's going to be a more transparent world. And you'll have two worlds. You'll have the transparent world and the non-transparent world. And like Satoshi said, dude, I sound like a freaking like religious nut, don't I? He said, like a quote Satoshi, he said, we don't want to end the Fed. We want to transcend the Fed, create a better Fed.
Satoshi might, this might go down as a religion. Let's see how it plays out.
It is. It's the best religion. Honestly, I just read a book about it, about religions, and Bitcoin is a modern, is our modern day religion. Like, we've not had a new religion in decades, in a long time, in 100 years. Tell me what other movement like that completely, it's like, Christianity, it didn't matter who you were, where you're from, what you were, every religion when they launched, it's fully accepting. What other religion is fully accepting other than Bitcoin? It has principles, no. morals, beliefs, equality, embracing equality, fairness. Its roots go are, it's like the early Bitcoin talk forums. It didn't matter if you're like missing a leg or if you're black, white, purple, green. It didn't matter your what you believe from a sexual standpoint or your religion. It didn't matter. We were all just together as one and fun. And that's like, the, for me, the ethos of Bitcoin. You were judged on what you bring to the table and not the pedigree before you.
No, totally. Well, hey, I want to respect everyone's time here, but if you guys got a few more minutes, I'm going to get maybe one more question in for each of the students. Danny, you want to take us?
Yeah. I got one last question. I guess my main question is, how do you learn and who do you learn from? Not really like a Bitcoin historic question, but how do you learn?
I'll plug my own podcast here. I've been podcasting for 4 years under the Charlie Shrem Show. You can find it wherever you get your audio, from YouTube, Spotify, Apple. 356 episodes in. I'm very detailed on the show notes and the titles. So if you want to learn about anything, I go in depth with the people. If you want to learn about Ethereum, I have the founders of Ethereum. If you want to learn about Cardano, I've had the founder of Cardano. He's my friend. If you want to learn about Polygon, anything you want to learn about any company, I have had the owner or the people that have started it on the show. So that's my plug. Other than that, it's hard. It's hard to learn. It's hard. What I would do is I would tell someone, and someone needs to do this. Someone needs to like create an abridged version of the Bitcoin chat rooms and the forums into like a book format, because I think it's very helpful to understand the days. If you could understand from when the moment from Satoshi launched the white paper, and then you understand the white paper and launched the world that he was launching that into, up until when Vitalik launched Ethereum and all the conversations that happened in those chats, you will be so well-versed that there is nothing further for you to learn. No blockchain will launch that you won't understand. You'll inherently understand things like ZK rollups. You'll inherently understand how capital cycles. You'll inherently understand how all blockchains work together, bridges, tunnels, attacks, DeFi, how to be able to detect. Now, if you don't have the time to do that and you want to like start from somewhere, I always say like, go look at some of the crypto obituaries and look at the projects that have failed and learn why they failed. Arthur Hayes, the creator of BitMEX, told me the best way to learn how to make money in crypto is to learn how to lose money in crypto. And so literally download an app where you can buy and sell different cryptos, put like $1,000 in there, and literally buy the worst ones you possibly can. Go and just try to lose. Play, have a game with all your friends. Who can lose the most amount of money as fast as possible or as slow as possible in like the most detailed mechanisms, and actually like prove in a thesis why you chose these, like the worst. And I promise you the next time around, you just won't even think. You'll know exactly which ones to invest in.
A lot of good points. And I thought you were going to say ChatGPT. That's how everyone.
That's the easy answer right now. But the problem with
no, you know what? You gave me an idea. I've been playing. I write code for a long time, but I've been playing around with the API. Like I want to go like scrape these forum sites and then like feed it back into ChatGPT to like have it summarize it, you know, like could actually like extrapolate content from that. It would be interesting.
It's not a bad idea. It wouldn't be a hard thing to do. You'd have to like, I think what you'd have to do is you'd have to like, so someone took, if you go to NakamotoInstitute.org, they took all the writings of Satoshi and they also got like all the people like me who had private emails with Satoshi. They got all of us to send them in. So you can actually read all of the private ones too. I would go there because they've abridged it pretty well, but it's not in narrative form. It's missing like the context.
Sure.
I need to do it. Like I need to like do like for the Jewish people in the room, I need to do like a Maimonides of like the Old Testament, like a commentary on the Bible. So like if the writings of Satoshi are the Bible, I need to write a book of like just the commentary on it, like a Rashi or something. I don't know.
I like it. I have some ideas too. I might have a loan email you separately.
Yeah, let's do it for sure.
Yeah. Anthony, you want to come in here with your last question?
Yeah, of course. So I mean, just like looking at the entire ecosystem, big picture, like financial return probably got some people into the ecosystem, but the people that are here now, you know, during crypto winter, there's something that like clicked for these people that it's hard to like put exactly into words what that is for each individual because it's different.
Yep.
But what do you think has to click in order for mass adoption to be adopted?
I think it's going to be, yeah, it's a great question. Well, you guys ask great questions. Okay. So I had this great question yesterday with the chief strategy officer over at Fox Corporation. And she said, do you remember the moment? I do. And anyone who's over 30 will remember. But there was a moment when there was a TV show called American Idol. And at the time, season one of American Idol was like the most watched show in the world at the time. And, you know, you had like Kelly Clarkson, Ruben Studdard, Clay Aiken, some famous, really like famous people came out of the first few seasons of American. But American Idol, it got really popular because you can call with your landline and vote. So there was this interaction. And that was maybe as the internet did that. Who knows? And then you had this moment. It was a watershed moment where all of a sudden, while you're watching American Idol, you can text to vote. And you had literally, there was an episode, Ryan Seacrest, literally like walking you over the TV with a microphone, teaching you how to send a freaking text message. Like it's, if you watch it now on YouTube, it's insane to like how to, of course. And that introduced text message voting. So because they forced America, friction is freedom, to have a little bit more friction. But now Americans had the freedom to like text from their couch and they could vote over text messages. Like think of the powerful implications that were going on in people's heads at the time. Changed everything. So Bitcoin and crypto needs those moments. We've had some of them, but SMS never had an incentive layer and internet never had an incentive layer. So the internet just had like one boom bust cycle, the dot-com bust. It was one time. It was related to the stock market. But Bitcoin and crypto have these tokens and this incentivized layer that we always get ahead of ourselves. And that's why we have all these boom and bust cycles. But I would argue that it's happening now. Like mass adoption's happening. We're growing. It's time. Like it's already going to be a thing when college students are in college and Bitcoin existed for their whole adult life. Like you guys grew up in a world without Bitcoin. So you're that still like hybrid era. And so like your older brothers and sisters' kids are going to be the ones growing up in a world that never existed without Bitcoin. And it's a crazy thing to think about.
And actually, that's a great point, I think. And I'll take us out here. And really, I've enjoyed this conversation. And I think, you know, whatever, for the maybe thousands of students or whatever watching this, you know, I think I can speak from like the Mousebelt experience, right? So going back like 2017, since we've been helping schools, back then there was like no accredited courses, right? Like we're having to give a grant to like UCLA, like for their first course, right? Like I'm helping these student blockchain clubs, like hundreds of them all around the world. Some schools are getting letters or students getting letters like in early 2018, like, hey, we can't have your association associated with this drug coin called Bitcoin, right? Like there was still this like hangover from Silk Road. And I think maybe even right now, like what would your advice be to like the students watching it? Like maybe their mom or their grandma's calling them like after this FTX thing, like, oh, hey, are you sure you want to be involved in that Bitcoin thing? Like I'm seeing all this negative stuff on the news, right? Like, so what would your advice be to like students who are thinking about this as a career and how would you be thinking about that if you were studying today in university?
I would say that you're lucky because starting any business in bad times and then building it for good times is a lot easier than starting a business in good times and then waiting for the bad times. It's a lot easier to launch a company. It's harder, let me tell you, but in the long run, it's a lot better. Every single crypto business that is around today, still standing, Coinbase included, launched in a bear market. Binance, every single one of them. And the reason they're still standing, FTX launched in a bull market. The reason they're standing is because they built for the bear and then waited for the bull. So if these are bad times, I would say you're lucky. If we were talking about this and we're in a bull market, I would tell people to wait.
Definitely. Well, for anyone who's watching this, we definitely hope you enjoyed this talk. I know I did. It's been really awesome, actually, to hear your perspective, having been around in this industry for so long. And again, I encourage anyone here who's watching this, it is super important. Like, go read. Like, there's a book called The Block Size Wars. Go read that. Go read about, like, the impact a lot of these people had and, like, understand that there's a lot of nuance, I think, to how we got to this point. And you know, I think it's pretty important to understand the history. So, Danny, Anthony, Charlie Shrem, it was great talking to you guys. And for everyone watching, we hope you enjoy it. And we'll get to the next interview here soon. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive. AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.